tuning in to Full Service Radio.
Full Service Radio.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service Radio.
Full Service Radio is proudly supported and hosted by Simplecast, the easiest way for a podcast creator to publish and distribute audio on the internet. For more information, visit simplecast.com.
Hey everybody, welcome to Industry Night with Foodie and the Beast. David and Nikki Nellis broadcasting from our gorgeous glassed-in studio here in the fabulous Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. You know, Nikki and I have been doing a show on broadcast radio for the last 10 years or so, and it's a variety show. It's a food and wine variety show.
Called Foodie and the Beast.
Called Foodie and the Beast. That's why this is called Industry Night with Foodie and the Beast. And that's more, you know, people in and out in seven-minute segments. And we have chefs and oystermen and farmers and distillers and brewers and all of that, and that's fine. But this show's a little bit of a different format. It's a deep dive into a single subject. And there's probably nobody on the face of the earth I'd rather take a deeper dive with than Greg Engert, who is the beer psalm to the stars. Todd, you might have seen Greg on the front of Food and Wine a couple of years ago, right? Am I right?
Or somewhere he wasn't there. On the front,
I'm
but he was
in a spread.
He was in Food and Wine.
Don't I remember a
don't
spread?
Don't oversell it.
But it's the first time beer psalms have been featured, right?
Yeah. I think the only beer psalm.
Yes, the only beer psalm. Exactly.
Look at you.
No. Where are you going? Sit down.
So we also have Todd Thrasher with us. Todd is the, if Greg is the beer brewer to the stars, Todd Thrasher is the mixologist to the stars here in D.C., and he's joining us as well, and he's a hale and hearty fellow, well met.
Well, and so Todd is here at the Line Hotel. He is the spirited advisor for Eric Bruner Yang.
Is that your title, spirited?
That's my title.
That's the title. No, I made it up. I'm just guessing.
I don't know. I thought you were clever.
If she made it up, it's a good one.
She's
good
clever. One. She could have made that up.
But he's here at the Line Hotel with Brothers and Sisters, and he's developed the entire cocktail program. So, and he is joining us almost every time now on Industry Night here at Foodie and the Beast. Greg, Todd, please tell us what you've made for us. Yes, that is Greg. I haven't even had a drink yet.
So today, this is one of the first cocktail I came up with for Brothers and Sisters. This is called It's Not for a Sock Anymore. It's an aperitif cocktail to get you started. It's Green Hat Gin. It is Koki Rosa. And I took a little red shiso. Shiso is a Japanese herb that's a little hint of licorice,
it's
a little hint
very
of
herbaceous.
Lemony.
I love it.
And
it's
so delicious.
And it's all combined. So pink ginny cocktail, and we're going to do another pink ginny cocktail.
We should mention
later.
Green Hat Gin is also distilled here in Washington.
That's right. We're all about distilling in Washington.
The local guys. All right.
All right, y'all. Have fun. I'll be back in a bit.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
All right. So, Greg, you didn't grow up, and they didn't wean you on beer. They weaned you on something else.
Well, maybe. We don't know his parents. Maybe they started him young.
Daddy. Never mind.
I'm just, waiting to jump in here.
No, go ahead.
Yeah.
I mean, how did it all happen?
He's like, hey, am I a guest? Go ahead.
My parents definitely enjoy cocktails. So, in some sense, that's correct. I don't know. My dad, I mean, I remember my dad was somebody who was drinking craft beer when all of his buddies were drinking industrial lager way back when. So, that was definitely a big thing. I mean, I remember him drinking Sierra Nevada in, the late 80s, I think, before it really kind of took off.
Am I as old as your dad?
You're older than his dad.
No.
Yes.
How old's your dad?
70.
Oh, no.
Oh, no.
I'm younger.
By, a year.
No, because, all right. Nothing. I was just thinking about when I first started drinking Sierra Nevada, which was in the 80s.
Right.
When your dad was drinking it.
Right. Well, it launched in 79, 80. So, I was around it then. And then, going to school in Vermont, I went to Middlebury College, which I know you have some connection to.
His ex-ex-wife went to grad school.
Number one.
Yes, this is Nellis number one. I'm number three.
Number one.
I saved the best for last.
It is really if not uncomfortable,
and listen,
just so you know.
If I recall, number one was studying Italian.
Yes.
That's right.
And you worked at Mr. Ups.
Right.
That's right. So Middlebury College is, Middlebury College, Mr. Ups is a watering
a
hole
landmark.
In town. A landmark. And so we had Otter Creek Brewing Company there. We had Vermont Pub and Brewery up in Burlington. So I really started jumping into craft beer then.
So what year is this?
98.
Okay, 98. So that's really like at the cusp.
It is. And what's crazy is, just to put it in perspective, craft beer came on the scene, you know, small artisanal producers, in the mid to late 70s. Mm-hmm. In 1979, 1980, when Sierra Nevada launched, and actually when I was born, there are about 80 breweries in the U.S.
He just wants you to know how young he is. Go ahead.
I don't feel like that anymore.
You can curse on this show.
That was better 10 years ago.
How's that?
So in 1979, there's 80 breweries in the U.S. In 1996, I think there's nearly 1,800. So it's coming up, right?
At this point, we're seeing things like Sierra Nevada. We're seeing Sam Adams.
Yeah. Anchor Steam was out before that.
Yep. All of a sudden, we're seeing these new, like, they feel like smaller breweries popping up. It's almost like coffee, like first wave, second wave, third wave.
Totally. And so this was the first wave. And the first wave ran into problems in the mid-90s. So it got big, and then it started to die down a little bit.
Why?
Oversaturation. People weren't ready. Distribution networks weren't out there.
And Bud Miller
were much bigger. Were they putting the kibosh on it? Were the big guys like killing it?
Totally. And
I don't mean like killing it in a good way. I mean, were they like putting a bullet in it?
Absolutely.
Okay.
And think about it this way. I mean, it wasn't, I always like to say, so jumping ahead a little bit, when we opened Church Key and Birch and Barley in DC on 14th Street in 2009, no one cared what kind of coffee they drank.
Right.
Serious. So imagine that 10 years before, people weren't into flavor like they are even almost 10 years ago now.
They didn't even know there was anything else.
Right. So the fact that craft got as big as it did in the 90s is kind of astonishing. And the fact that it slowed down makes a lot of sense.
Well, what do you think? I mean, I remember all of a sudden people were like brewing beer at home. And
wasn't brewing beer? I mean, we're sort of all over the map here, but brewing beer was really big like in the late 60s and 70s. Wasn't that like a total hippie thing to do? I mean, you were a hippie. Didn't you do that?
No, I was a different kind of hippie.
Oh, okay.
I was too busy with drugs to worry about brewing beer.
So that's actually connected to home brewing laws in the U.S. So Prohibition put the kibosh on lots of home brewing, home winemaking, obviously home distilling. And so it wasn't until the Carter administration in the late 70s that home brewing was once again legalized. And so while people were probably doing it before then, it took off.
It didn't have the same sort of cult following.
Exactly.
Right?
And then small home brewers started parlaying their passion into small breweries, and it all took off from there.
Okay, so now let's back you up.
Right.
So you're in college. You're introduced to this beer scene. What brings you down to DC and like then uplifts this passion?
Totally. So I, in the meantime, after I spent some time abroad in college, and that's where I started getting introduced to international beer. And that was a revel.
Where were you?
So I lived in Trinity. I lived in Dublin, Ireland. I went to Trinity College. And then I also lived in Munich and went to the Goethe Institute and started drinking all sorts of beers.
Mass quantities.
Can I just stop for a minute?
Yeah.
Goethe is the word, when you see it, you say, oh, Goethe.
Yes, correct.
Thank you.
So introduced to flavors I'd never had. I mean, I was drinking IPAs and pale ales mostly in America, and now drinking stouts and porters and bitters and milds in the British Isles, and then drinking like Hefeweizen and classic pilsners and lagers in Germany. So while I have to admit, this was all still very much like intoxicating. It wasn't like academic at this point. I was getting exposed.
Because you were still in college.
Right.
I mean, we understand.
But wait a minute. Yeah. Were you getting DUIs for driving on the American side of the road?
No, thank God. They didn't let me get behind the wheel. I was kind of aware of everything. And then I went to grad school at Georgetown, and that's how I got to D.C., couple of years into that, decided I needed something new and ended up working my first server job ever and bartending gig at the Brickskeller.
Right.
In D.C.
Which at that time and for years before.
That was where you went.
That's where you supposedly where you supposedly went because they had the craziest beer selection.
And you know what? Well, I was just going to say we would go there and nobody knew what the fuck was going on.
But
we'd look at the menu and it was like.
Yeah, but it wasn't about good beer. It was just about an incredible volumes. List
right.
of beers.
Like, right, but that's what I mean.
Everybody would talk about, oh, you can get a pineapple beer. Like, that meant anything.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
Totally. And that's exactly what happened. So I show up. And so this place started in 1957. And even I've seen menus from 57. They had like 25 beers on their menu in 1957. Like, that's insane amount of beer.
But in the 80s, they had like...
It started going crazy. Right.
Yeah.
Right. And by the time I got there, they had 2,000 varieties. But to your point, Nikki, there was no curation at all. It was just like a list.
It was just like whatever Guinness Barrel. Like, how do we become the biggest seller of beers from around the world?
No nuance.
Right?
Just, yeah, exactly. Just like, I'll take it. And, you know, and then at that point, too, to David's point, there was no education behind it.
Sure.
And so I walked into a situation where it seemed like, you know, we should be doing what sommeliers were doing with wine. Mm-hmm. And I had all of these tools at my, you know, at the ready. And so I saw kind of an opening and an opportunity.
So how did you go about it? Because, I mean, I'm sure there were people there that knew beer, but did you...
Totally.
I mean, how'd you get your education?
I was extremely competitive, and I wanted to be the best at whatever I did there. So I just started reading every single thing I get my hands on. This is before, like, the internet had a lot of info to give us, 2004 or so. So, like,
I mean, I don't think Googling it was even a term.
I don't think
right?
so. Right?
Like, we knew about Google, but like, you didn't ask it or ask Siri for you know, the massive amounts of information you can now get.
I use Lugal.
What?
Hot tub time machine. You never saw it.
Never mind.
Thank you.
And so, yeah, you couldn't, like, and all of, like, the beer rating sites that exist today, like Beer Advocate, Rate Beer, Untappd, none of that existed back then, really. So, you know, it was just books. So I'm just reading, tasting.
Were there publications? Were there any publications dedicated to beer?
Yeah. But they were like, you know, kind of flimsy print publications like Celebrator Beer News out of California, Ale Street News out of from the East Coast, Mid-Atlantic Brewing News. So there were like these like trade type pamphlets and magazines that were available. And they were great. I mean, chock full of information. We'd read those cover to cover as well. And then the great thing about the Brickskeller, though, was that it was the hotspot for brewers. So if you were anybody in beer, you went to the Brickskeller.
Really?
So I get to meet everyone. Like Michael Jackson, who is the most, you know, famous beer and whiskey writer that really kickstarted a lot of what happened with craft beer, would come there at least twice a year to hold tastings. He did his 60th birthday there. So, you know, Garrett Oliver from Brooklyn Brewery, Ken Grossman from Sierra, the who's who of beer was rolling through there daily. So it was an opportunity to pick their brains. And then to start developing training programs to get the staff to do what we all knew we should be doing.
Now, did the owners like that, or did they say, "Nah, you don't need that"? Or
it was met with
who was the owner?
Ambivalence, I think, in some respects. Dave Alexander and his wife Diane were the owners, but
I would imagine for them they were thinking, if it's not broke, Don't fix it. You know, I'm sure they're thinking, I mean, they had it's before the boom in D.C., before the initial boom. Forget about the second boom of restaurants in D.C. They're probably, you know, they had kids there, you know, young people there to drink every night, as well as people who, you know, maybe were interested in beer. When people came to town, they were like, what's a D.C. institution? It was the Brickskeller. You have to go to the Brickskeller because they have more beers than anybody else.
Right.
Right? That was the story. So I could see them sort of thinking... Because, like, why would we do this?
Exactly. I mean, even back then, just to go back to all of us who were in D.C. at that time, think there's only probably three neighborhoods that people drank in, generally.
DuPont, right. Georgetown,
and
Adams Morgan.
Maybe U Street Corridor.
Oh,
no.
Barely.
No, not then.
No. In 2000? Absolutely. So.
Maybe. I mean,
Hopi's was on...
right. You didn't Hopi's go below 12th Street, though.
Right. Yeah, you stopped there.
And Capitol Hill.
Right. That's it.
But, like... Even in Capitol Hill, it was like you
right
know,
on Pennsylvania Avenue,
a block by a block.
So at that point, there weren't a ton of options.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, it's crazy thinking about DC today. I mean, there were a ton of jobs. It was hard to get a restaurant job, a server job, a bartending job. So yeah, there was just no competition. So to your point, Nikki, yeah, they weren't exactly excited about investing in things that would change, you know, or infrastructure, but. things changed pretty dramatically in the mid-2000s. And so that's where I was able to kind of jump away. And because they were resistant and they weren't going to get behind it, kind of modernizing. And I wanted to do more than just, you know, train staff and treat guests properly. I had a lot of other kind of ideas. So,
okay, so how did you hook up with Michael Babin at Neighborhood Restaurant Group? Because at that time, he had Planet Wine. Evening Star Cafe.
Vermilion.
I mean, no.
In Tallulah.
But there was no restaurant with a beer program. Uh-huh. He had the Planet Wine, so he had a decent wine program. And I believe when you joined, and I could be off by a year or two, but Gina Chersavani was creating the cocktails.
She came in right after me.
Right after you. Right, okay. Yeah.
So
I know my energy history here or what?
Well. She has a lot of energy.
So Michael Babin and Neighborhood Restaurant Group had already created some incredible places, but it was primarily wine-driven, like you said. Evening Star, Planet Wine, Vermilion, Tallulah. And Tallulah was really cool. I mean, it had dozens and dozens of wine, temperature controls on the wine. It was a really high-end wine place.
It was also the epitome of a neighborhood restaurant because it was sort of in the middle of
nowhere.
Yeah,
in Arlington.
And people would make these treks there
from
Maryland, D.C. to this place in Virginia, and then they developed the Eat Bar concept too at the bar. I mean, at the time, everything that was going on there was so unique.
And that was 2004.
It was so different. Yeah. I mean, it seems so, to look back now, to really see what people were so into it.
Yeah.
Everybody, like, when that restaurant opened and when the Eat Bar concept broke onto the scene, people are like, "Where? How do we get there? Like, we need to go." It was really fascinating.
Because it was new and different. I mean, and Nathan Anda, who, of course, now works with me, and he's, you know, a butcher at Red Apron.
Mm-hmm.
He was the opening chef at Tallulah Eat Bar.
Right.
Developed all of the Red Apron charcuterie out of the shed in the back.
Okay, and he also makes the best hamburger in town.
Yeah, absolutely. We do love his burgers, Red Apron burgers.
You know, so this is so imagine. So, okay, so what happened then was that Michael and the group decided they wanted to open a beer place. Craft beer started coming up, and they started thinking about it in 2005 and then opened Rustico in Alexandria in 2006, March of 2006.
Now, you're there at this point.
No.
Oh, so, I thought you were there for the Rustico opening.
No. I was kind of like, I got called in quickly after the opening. So I was still at the Brickskeller, but at this point had already begun making moves to kind of do my own thing at that point. You know, I knew what I wanted to do with beer. I knew it was going to happen at the Brickskeller, and I just felt like I was going to have to try to convince somebody to let me do that with them.
Right.
Because it was pretty radical back then, you know, like what I was after. And so the cool thing was that Michael heard about me. I'd started to do some like seminars and lots of trainings outside of the Brickskeller, make a little bit of a name for myself. And the initial person they had involved doing the beer there didn't work out. So I was introduced to him. We met, talked for probably 3 hours. Hardly any of it was about the restaurant. We just were very similar people and like we're buddies right away. It was pretty clear that we had exactly the same ideas. And, you know, right, the autonomy was there from the start. He was like, listen, you know, what you're talking about doing with beer is what we've been doing with wine and service, and I would love to work with you to help you do more of that. And right from the start, the cool thing was it was like, we're going to work on Rustico, but there's a lot of things you want to do that Rustico's not built for, so let's get Rustico on track and then talk about some new stuff. And, you know, at that point, we had energy.
Talk about like a golden carrot. I mean, how could you say no to that kind of opportunity? Great.
But exactly. But, you know, I have lots of friends who have had, I think, similar conversations with restaurateurs.
Mm-hmm.
And those partnerships have gone by the wayside.
Yeah.
So
yes.
For me, it was all about the fact that Michael is, an amazing guy. I had a great feeling about him and the group and everybody I met right away. And so everything that's happened is really cool. But yeah, I mean, I got definitely lucky.
Okay, so you're building the beer program at Rustico,
mm-hmm.
which I feel like, even though he's already said, we're going to give you a different concept after this.
Mm.
How do you go about really building, like, initially, that's your first. So I feel like for you, there's like Greg Point One, 0.2 yeah. and 0.3. So we have, and probably a 0.4, but like we have Greg doing the beer at Rustico. Mm-hmm. Then we have the opening of Birch and Barley and Church Key, which is totally out of the stratosphere for any place in the country. And then we have Blue Jacket. So how does, you know, Greg point, oh, 0.01 or 1.0? Like, what is
101.
It? 101.
Right. Like, so high tech.
How did you come up, like, what was your vision initially for Rustico? And then how did that spur your vision yeah. for the next step?
Yeah. So Rustico is crazy because in 2006 in Northern Virginia, people were hesitant about craft beer. And so when I walked into Rustico, it was 30 draft beers and I think nearly 300 bottles and a few cans. However, and one cask ale, but a lot of it was what we would call kind of like faux craft. So they had like Pilsner Urquell and Stella and Magic Hat number 9 and Guinness. There was Miller Lite on draft. I think they had PBR on draft. So it was a little
before
bit of
before it was ironic.
Filler. Yes,
to have far, PBR yeah, I know, on right. draft.
I know. I think it may just have ironic. Just become ironic.
Uh-huh.
Because they also had like cans of like Keystone and Schlitz and like so there was it wasn't a list that had gone all the way. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I was saying to Michael when I first went in there was like, if I come aboard, I want to have carte blanche control over the entire list right from day one. And he was down with that. Mm-hmm. Maybe he should have been a little bit more concerned. And so
but hindsight is always 20/20.
I know. And so I went in there and, you know, I knew the first thing is I didn't want anything to be global industrial. Everything needed to be passion driven. So the way that I define craft is like flavor first mentality. You know, if you can make some money on it and stay in business, that's great. But the overarching principle is to make something you want to drink and hopefully others will do it. And so when I got in there, there were a lot of breweries that were more profit over and efficiency over flavor. We ripped those out, put in a bunch of new ones, including things people had never drank in Northern Virginia. And there was a bit of a backlash immediately. So it led me to figure out a way.
Backlash is in, where's my Schlitz? I mean, you know, people saying, oh, yeah. Wait a minute, I thought you had...
No, whatever. No. Coming in and being like...
I don't know this.
Who's this asshole from D.C. who just came out here and thinks he knows more about beer than us or thinks that these beers are not good enough? You know, they were looking to kind of frame me, I think, as a pretentious...
And were you an asshole from D.C.?
So am I, yeah. No, I think I was. I was... This is it. I was so concerned about
so
that.
Passionate, though. I mean, what's a... tragic,
but
obviously
kind of young, I think, and that was not
well.
Helpful.
You're young, but you know, but that didn't betray your passion for the movement. And you know, it is like we were talking about earlier. It is hard for people to change if it's if it's not broke, don't fix it, kind of thing.
If
but
it ain't broke, that's
it ain't broke. But there was a movement happening, and you happened to be there.
Yeah,
yeah, but
you were at the
and
forefront.
Are you talking about people in the restaurant resisting you, or the patrons?
Patrons mostly, a little bit of restaurant.
Because
people.
For patrons, you say, you know what, try this. If
right.
you don't like
and
it,
that's what happens.
Spit it out.
Yeah, but exactly. I could see some of the staff fighting back too.
There was a little sure. bit of that too. I was able to kind of make my way. I mean, the cool thing was that the craft thing was happening. But I was pushing it a little bit faster and harder, I think, and a little bit more with a little bit more unbridled intensity about it. I was less willing to compromise and more. I just felt that if we're going to do this craft thing, we should actually do the craft thing and support small artisan brewers who back then needed our help. They right. literally nobody was buying craft beer in 2006. If you wanted craft beer, you went to the Brickskeller on 22nd of P, or you went to the basement of Pizzeria Paradiso in Georgetown.
Right, the birria.
Or you went to Rustico
in Virginia.
In Alexandria.
Right.
Oh, and the Saloon on U Street, oddly enough. Those were the places. You didn't go to your neighborhood bar.
You and you couldn't buy it anywhere. Right. Yeah. You can't. Well, there were no Whole Foods.
Or Fresh Fields. Right.
Right. Yeah. But even then, I mean, there was like two Fresh Fields.
Yeah.
You know, but even then, like, it's not even like they were even carrying it.
No.
And I don't think even Sutton Place was carrying it.
No.
Nobody cared. No. And that was the thing. It was like, it wasn't like it was just everybody was fighting to get the best beers. It was literally, I was begging distributors to carry brewers' beers so that we could buy them from them. And so it was, so we got there trying to do that, and all these people were kind of hesitant. I had to come up with a way to make these beers kind of figuratively palatable rather than just delicious. And that's where I came up with this flavor profile system that was inspired by Josh Wesson at what's it called? Bestsellers. Mm-hmm. There's one on DuPont.
Yep, I remember it. Right.
And I love the way that he left behind regionality or even
well, for people varietals. Who don't recall, because it didn't last long, Bestsellers, but it was a wine store, and they totally broke it down for you so that when you came in, it wasn't intimidating to buy wine. It was an incredible program.
It was amazing.
But it was in DuPont Circle, and it couldn't last, but whatever.
Exactly, and that's what's wrong. And so, but I would go there and be like, this is the best way to think about wine, especially for people who are intimidated. So we started to categorize beer by broad flavor profiles rather than region, which doesn't tell you much, or style. And so you could, you know,
if which also doesn't tell you much if you don't know a lot about beer.
No, you tell somebody it's a Saison. What does that mean?
Exactly. Season. Especially when a Saison can be.
Oh, you're so smart. But you don't know how to say if it ain't broke. So.
And Saisons can actually be like, they can be crisp, they could be hoppy, they could be sweet, they could be sour. So to tell that wouldn't matter. And so that was a really cool thing. We did that system. It helped us with training staff, with talking about food and beer pairings, which began there, and with turning the guest on to things that they had never seen before and just making it accessible rather than pretentious.
All right, I'm going to stop you there. Yeah. We got to take a break.
Do we want to take a break now?
It's 5:30.
Okay, we'll take a break. And when we come back, let's get to, because Birch and Barley and Church Key were, that was an enormous change. It also culminated with the time of DC opening up their own breweries and Virginia, Maryland.
Totally.
I mean, all of a sudden, there's a tidal wave. So this is David and Nikki Nellis. You're listening to Industry Night. We're talking to Greg Engert about, he's got beer, lots of it. We're going to find out
more.
You're
going to have to open some of that stuff eventually.
Original music by Kido, K-I-E-D-O on SoundCloud. We'll be right back.
All right, we're back on Industry Night with Foodie and the Beast. Our guest tonight is Greg Engert, who is, I think without, nobody would contest that you're the foremost or one of the foremost beer somms in the country. Maybe the world, the planet, the galaxy.
Well,
I don't know.
The expert.
But you were there. You kind of rode at the front of the train with the craft beer revolution here in D.C. and led the charge in a lot of ways. So where we left off, we were talking about how you joined Neighborhood Restaurant Group and went to the first spot you went to was Rustico, where you opened that up and you where they opened it up. And you went in and changed the beer profile and brought in craft beers and kind of confused people. And that's where we kind of left.
Well, yeah,
it.
But now, so let's, I mean, because we only have an hour.
Yeah.
So let's talk about, because when Birch and Barley and Church Key hit the scene, you had 500
well,
beers.
Can we say for people who are not in D.C., who
yes.
are listening around the world,
yes.
that Church Key and Birch and Barley and Church Key, it's basically a bar on top of a restaurant on 14th Street, on 14th Street in D.C. And you opened up really, again, when 14th Street wasn't, I mean, 14th Street was closed down for decades because of the riots in the 60s.
Yeah, you guys were at the very beginning.
It was almost like after a forest fire, after a while, the seeds that are there take root and you start to see flowers.
Yeah,
and that's kind of what happened with what is now probably the best outdoor restaurant mall in the city, 14th Street.
Yeah, and I mean, I remember when we first got there, it was like Black Cat, Cinex, Bar Pilar just opened, and of course, Studio Theater and Whole Foods had gone in earlier.
But it was just happening.
Just barely.
You know what I mean?
Like, it's certainly not down at the end
where you are.
Yeah, where we are. Yeah.
Okay, but so let's talk about what your vision was.
Sure.
Because they were both really the carrot that Michael dangled in front of you.
Yeah.
They were your vision. And what was so when you guys opened, you had 500 beers?
555.
Okay, and how many lines did you have? Because you had like an organ, like a literal, like the lines you could, like it was an organ. You developed an entire system to deliver the beers.
The beer, right. So 50 draft beers.
Right.
But pouring on two floors, so split 50 and 50, same beers, but they split, and that's what kind of like spidered down. 500 bottles. And five cascales, like real ales, hand pumped like the British do, all in constant rotation. And that, the massiveness of the list was one thing, but you know.
But it was also the quality.
Yes, and that was what was more important for me because, you know, like I said, back in 2006 when we opened Rustico, nobody was drinking craft beer, and we wanted them to. And I believed in it, and I thought that beer, and still do believe that beer is as noble a beverage, an interesting and delicious a beverage as wine, spirits, cocktails of any kind. And it was so cool to be able to introduce everybody to it. Nobody knew about this stuff at all, you know?
Yeah, but from a business perspective, you got 555 beers.
Yeah.
Not everything's selling. So how did you, basically, how did you keep from losing your shirt bringing in beers that might have been great but a little esoteric nobody?
It was all about knowing. Just like with wine, some things lay down well in age and others need to be drank incredibly fresh. So we would, you know, serve some of the beers that need to be drank immediately, you know, crisp, refreshing lagers, IPAs, double IPAs, whatever, mostly on draft where they're going to be moving more quickly. And then things that lay down better, stouts, porters, Belgian beers,
would be around for a while
in bottles and cans. But even more importantly, we stored everything and still do at the perfect temp and serve it at the perfect time. So that was the other thing, is that in 2006, 7, 8, more and more beer was becoming available. People were starting to get into it, but there was a lack of like...
education.
And care. Mm-hmm. And that sommelier's like mentality behind it. So we said, what if we find the best beers in the world and then echo the passion and the talents of the brewers in our service? And so that's when we started to temperature control all of our bottles and cans. We were the first people in the U.S. to build a draft system that would dispense beer at different temperatures where it would be best tasted based on style. We'd employed 15 different glasses.
I was going to say your glassware alone.
Like a menagerie of glasses. Yeah,
right.
Just like all over the place. And then clean the lines, the faucets, the couplers, all of the components of the system in an obsessive manner so that brewers would come and say, our beers taste as great at Bertram Riley and Churchkey as they do at the brewery. Mm-hmm. That was the goal, and it worked out.
Well, and also culminating at the same time, you had this tremendous growth in craft beers.
Exactly.
So you would start doing like where now it's. I mean, it's de rigueur. I mean, everybody does it. Mm-hmm. You know, we're tapping this and we're tapping that. But when you guys started doing it, people would line up. You would. Yeah. Mention a beer from, you know, Bim Bam Boo, and those that were the diehard fans would line up outside Churchkey
totally
to get in to get the first sip.
And it was like rotation. It was so cool is seeing the time when all the beers that I loved and I was finding nobody else cared about, the minute lines start forming, then every bar in the city wants them.
Sure.
And that started happening.
Of course.
But also what happened at the same time was social media.
Oh, right.
So like Twitter came about right as we were opening Churchkey, and I remember Michael and I talking about it, and Amber Fowle, and talking about how like we need to embrace this. And so we started telling everybody in real time about beer tappings, which nobody else was doing back then.
Sure.
And it was incredible, the response that we would get. You know, I'd be remiss in not mentioning the restaurant though, because you know,
you created food to go with the beer.
Yes, and just took the idea of food and beer pairing to another level. So our executive chef, Kyle Bailey, and his wife, our pastry chef, Tiffany McIsaac, I got incredibly lucky to work with them. They came down from New York, and the three of us started at Birch and Barley. I mean, I remember Tiffany demanding that I spend more time downstairs on the floor where I could explain the interactions of beer and food with the guests, rather than being upstairs talking with the beer geeks And it was one of the best, some of the best advice I ever got. And we did that. And so we really took off saying that beer can pair like wine. We started doing a tasting menu nightly that we've done every single day since late October 2009 when we opened. Instead of wine, beer and food, pairings. I don't know anybody else doing that in the U.S. still.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, for all the attention Churchkey got at first and still does, Birch and Barley, I think, is actually more singular in many respects.
Right. No, it was started to do things. Well, you had your own bread making program.
Yeah, that's
crazy. Right? Like you did making your own mustards. I mean, there was so much going on there. And that also involved Nate Anda because he started with his charcuterie.
Right. And which he was involved too.
Right. So there was just so many things going on.
Yeah, it was like, exactly. I mean, the greatest restaurants have a ton of really talented people doing really amazing things. Mm-hmm. And yeah, NRG and Birch and Barley, Churchkey, in the late 2000s, early 2010s was incredible for that.
Okay, so you open up this restaurant with this massive, well-curated beer program, which feels very hard to say when we're talking about over 500 beers. Mm-hmm. And you need more. This isn't enough for you. It's, you know, there's more to do. You decide you want to make your own beer.
Right.
What brought you to that point?
So actually, you know, back when I first interviewed with Michael, I think it was the second conversation we ever had, we started to develop a blueprint for what we wanted to do with beer. And we've always had dozens of ideas on the table. And what we kind of do is based on, well, the people that we have, the places we see. And so from those early conversations, the kernel of what would become Blue Jacket, our brewery, was born. Same thing for a second Rustico in Arlington. The unfortunately now defunct GBD, mm-hmm. what would become the Sovereign in Georgetown, Owen's Ordinary in MoCo. These beer programs.
That's Bethesda, Maryland.
Yeah, sorry. these beer programs all kind of started way back then. So we had talked about a brewery for a long time. And then we got Birch and Barley Churchkey open. It did really well. We took every penny that it made and dumped it into our next project, which would become the brewery. But we also discovered one of the most beautiful spaces in DC, which was the old this old naval factory for boiler making in Navy Yard in DC.
Well, not to mention, once again, you go down to an area that has yet to explode, right? So the stadium has opened,
mm-hmm.
but everything that they're predicting for what they call now the Navy Yard area, I mean, it was desolate. There was nothing down there, right?
There was the Navy Yard. There was our building, the Boilermaker building, which was empty, you know, no electricity. And then the stadium, which even when we signed the lease, was still being built. Or no, sorry, it had started, but was still nothing else down there.
I mean, but there was no walk. I mean, it seemed so far away.
No people were living there.
Right.
Which is what we love to be kind of the first and for neighborhoods to kind of be able to grow with us. And that definitely happened. So what we always wanted was a place where you could look at the brewery while you drank the beers. And what we wanted to do was to enter the conversation. We've been serving the best beers in the world for so long. We wanted to be inspired by those beers to innovate ourselves and to create, you know, versions of the beers that we had tasted. And we found a space where we could literally build a brewery up on three levels surrounding the bar and restaurant and just be this cool, immersive, really beautiful environment to drink beer.
And it is. But why would you, since you have all these beers, what was it that you were looking to make?
Oh, just like to create, to make beer. I mean, you can, being around brewers for that long and breweries and having done a lot of collaboration beers, the bug to be able to create your own was always there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it just didn't seem kind of viable for a long time because you mentioned earlier, DC is a crazy place. Like we had beer bars. We had the first beer bar in the U.S., Brick's Keller, 57. Then we had beer bars like Rustico, Pizzeria Paradiso in the 2000s. But we didn't get our first production brewery since the 1950s until DC Brow
right.
in 2012. So, and then we opened in 2013. So, you know, it didn't, I don't know. I didn't know if it could work, but we always wanted to brew. We wanted to create. And we wanted to see what would happen if, like, we could be inspired.
But I have to say, I mean, most of the, like, DC Brow and Three Star and Atlas, like, all those breweries that started in DC, they were really tiny. I mean, what you're doing It was a massive project. That space is massive. Yeah. It's also a restaurant.
Yeah.
I mean, and you're doing multiple kinds of beers.
Yeah. How many are now too, but yeah.
Right. I'm saying? Like, you didn't start small. You didn't have like a little brewery happening on the side. You built a massive brewery.
Well, so here's the interesting thing. DC Brow produced a much bigger brewery than ours. However, they were doing production brewing, concentrating on three or four styles in larger volumes. What we did was brew a small amount of beer in like 20 different styles.
Right.
So we made it incredibly inefficient, hard, but that's what I did because we wanted to not have
to commit.
Right,
so when you opened, how many beers did you offer? Because I feel like
20
there were 12.
Drafts.
Okay, I was going to say 12.
All 20 drafts and five casks. And then we started doing some bottlings. But yeah, I mean, we've done over, I think, maybe 400 beers in four years.
For people who don't know about what a cask means, can you explain that?
Sure. It's one of the most traditional forms of serving beer. The Brits do it the most. And so it looks like a keg of beer. Everybody knows those, like a big stainless steel tub turned on its side. And you tap it with like a faucet and open it up on top to let air in and pour it out. So basically it takes beer and puts it into a very basic vessel. And rather than adding carbonation to it or hooking it up to like a draft system, you just tap it like you would tap like a cask of wine or something like that. And all of the carbonation in there is naturally created by fermentation. Mm-hmm. There's no filtration. So in many ways, it's the most honest and authentic opportunity to taste the flavor of the beers. And they tend to have lower carbonation levels. We serve them chilled rather than cold so that there's more aromatics. And it's a throwback to the way beer would have been pumped out of cellars until the 1950s.
So now today, how many are you serving? Are you serving?
Five casks. Oh, still the same. We've kept that number up.
Never?
Yeah.
Okay.
As we've gone. So yeah, we've kept it up. But now, like DC Brow, we are trying to send more beer out, I would say, rather than just serving at the brew pub.
What do you mean?
So we've started to send some of our keg beer to festivals around the country and some of our favorite beer bars around the country. And we've also...
So does that count as... Now, are you a beer producer in that regard? Because before it was just to sell it on your own, brick and mortar place.
So we're still 90% doing that, but we love to like send out some beer to like just great beer bars throughout the U.S. and festivals and to our places and other places in D.C. and Northern Virginia.
Well, so how do you go from just serving at your place your beers to bringing it to other locations, bottling, everything? How do you do it?
So we don't bottle. We're just distributing kegs for now. But how we did it was we actually built the brewery to be able to increase volumes. So we could always make a lot of different beers, but now we're just making more of each of them. And we hired a really amazing, talented brewer from Colorado named Roel Gunzel, who has a lot of experience with this. So he's helped us kind of expand.
Okay, we're going to break away from you for 1 second because Todd Thrasher is back in the house.
And I'll bet this is an orange juice.
No.
I was going to do all gin all day today, but I changed my mind back there because I was working with Pisco. So this is a classic American cocktail from a gentleman named Duncan Nichol that was around the turn of the 19th century, or at the beginning of the 19th century in San Francisco. So it's just a Pisco punch. Pineapple juice, lime, and Pisco.
It's delicious.
It's delicious. It's
subversive
old school,
because you don't
cocktail.
Taste the Pisco at all.
Yeah, you don't taste anything. Pisco, as we know, is brandy.
And then the cop will say, "Sir, do you know how fast you were going?" I'll go, "I didn't even know I was driving."
So is this a cocktail that you serve here?
Yeah, so you know the list here is divided up between classic hotel cocktails, because I wanted to pay homage to great hotel bars, and then classic American cocktails, which this would fit in. And the first one, the Osaka, was a cocktail based on love, life, and music.
I love the first
Can I
one.
Say thank you for not making a fucking beer cocktail?
Yes,
I wasn't
you
gonna
can.
You drink beer all the time. It's like when I go to cocktail bars, I want to drink a beer or a glass of wine. I don't want cocktails.
I love.
Are we
anti-beer
cocktails? How do we feel about beer cocktails?
They're fine. They're good.
I don't get it.
Why? I don't get it. I wouldn't put
because
like,
he's a purist.
Well,
he's
put like, you know, expensive Burgundy into cocktails. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not gonna put beers. I don't know. It just doesn't work for me.
It's like a mimosa. just give me really good champagne.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
I don't really need the orange juice in there. No, thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. My wife was would argue with you yesterday morning at 8:30. She's like, I want a mimosa.
Well, then she can have one.
Yes.
She can do it. Maria can do her.
That's right.
I'm going to say, when she says I want a mimosa, he's like already out the door looking for mimosas.
Yes, honey. Ariel, have a good day.
He brings back a tree.
This is beautiful. And the glassware is so stunning.
Thank you, Eric Berner Yang.
Thank you. All right, thanks,
thank you,
Todd
Thrasher.
Fine, Todd Thrasher at the Line Hotel.
All right,
serving up great cocktails.
Lest we run out of time,
yes.
You guys are doing something new over there that you hadn't done before, and that's putting beer in cans.
Yeah.
Why?
So this is all part of that thing, like I was saying, you know, we're still a very small brewery, but we wanted to expand our reach a little bit, and we wanted to, you know, give people something they could take home. So for the longest time, people have been coming to Blue Jacket, loving our beers on draft and on cask, drinking them in-house, and wanting to bring beer home. And we don't really love to do growlers. You know, these are like, you know, glass bottles. Because a lot of times you end up having to use people's growlers they bring in that aren't necessarily as clean as you might like. Mm. You're filling them directly off a draft tower, which can introduce too much oxygen, maybe not be great for beer. But really, even beyond that, it's about like a bottleneck. You know, we're pretty busy down there. So nothing's worse than if you're waiting for a growler to be filled and people are, you know, the bartenders are busy with like bar staff, bar guests, or vice versa. It just didn't seem right to have to fill things on demand based on like the business that we have. And I don't think growlers are the best vessel for beer quality or beer drinking at the house. So what we did was we started filling some 750 milliliter bottles of beer, which we did for some time, like a really old school hand filling machine. Yep. And then, but all along, we really wanted to do some cans. So,
why? What's the significance of cans?
Significance is, well, first, like I said, people want to come in. They love the beer they've had there. They want to drink some at home, take home a can. But a can is the best vessel for taking home and drinking because it is impervious to air and oxygen.
Light.
So when light strikes beer, it skunks it. You know, like green bottles let a lot of light in. So when you drink Heineken, Stella that's come from overseas, it tastes skunky. Cans preclude that. Oxygen gets into beer. It makes it taste like cardboard and newspaper. With a can, no oxygen, no oxidation, it's going to last much longer and stay much fresher. So what we do is we found finally a vessel that we thought would be able to reflect the flavors of our beer in-house at your home. And so, and many other brewers had shown us that. So we were like, let's do it. But what we didn't have before that we have now is we didn't want to have to commit to making, you know, a truck full of one beer. We like to make lots of different beers. And so the canning industry and the associated industries around canning have changed so much recently that we get to do this the way that we want to do it. So rather than having to buy a truckload of cans up front and find a place to store them, which is what you used to have to do, now there's companies that will deliver, you know, a couple thousand cans to you whenever you want them.
It's called Amazon.
Exactly. And then rather than having to get cans printed and commit to one beer when you might want to make a new beer every week like we do, we can work with a digital printer who, in working with our creative director, Chris Mullins, who does all of our art for the whole group, he's amazing, he can get a design that we love over to the printer and we'll have it 5 business days later at in-house. So it gives us the creative wiggle room to continue to innovate, create, not have to stick to the beers we've made forever, not have to just make whatever we have because we have 1,000 printed cans that we need to get rid of. And so the industry has changed to let us to do it exactly how we want to do it.
So you have your first launch. It launched on Friday.
Yes.
So every Monday you're going to announce what's going to be available via can that Friday.
Yep.
And it can only be bought at the bottle shop, which is next door to
the brewery.
To the brewery.
At Blue Jacket.
Okay, right, Blue Jacket. So what's the first one that we put out?
So the first one, like the next couple, are going to be classic beers that people love at Blue Jacket. This one's called Lost Weekend. It is,
and I love the label.
Juice sounds like Las Vegas, but it's Lost Weekend.
Lost Weekend.
Lost Weekend.
It's a just a delicious, straightforward IPA, super aromatic. It's brewed with one kind of hop from the Pacific Northwest called Citra, and it's just been one of our most popular beers since we started. Mm-hmm. So it's a perfect beer for Cam.
I will crack one open with dinner.
Yes, David's very excited to crack one open.
It's a style of beer you actually like.
I know, you know that.
Yeah.
And so how will you decide each week what you're going to do. So like you've already, like today you announced your next two.
Totally. So what we have is, even though we can get these labels back pretty quickly, we still need to have some like flexibility. So Chris and our team has worked on these labels for a number of months now. So we have a lot at the ready. Mm-hmm. And so Ro, our brewmaster that I mentioned before, he and I on a Monday morning have a pretty good idea of what we want to release. We do some last minute tastings, commit to it, and then we announce package on Wednesday and Thursday and release on Friday.
So you can do it that quickly.
Yeah, well, we've already brewed the beer.
Right, I know. Right. But like, you make that decision instead of being like, you know, weeks out, like, okay, this is what we're going to do in April, this is what we're going to do in May. You can really be like, oh, this is tasting really good right now.
Right.
We're going to can
this. But you can only buy the cans at Blue Jacket, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
So as long as I've got the labels and we've communicated properly and the beers are in tank, I mean, we have 18 different fermenters filled with beer, so we have lots to choose from. We can make an on-the-fly decision, which is amazing. But also it means that I don't have to, if a beer's just not quite ready, we never have to put it out there until we think it's perfect.
Well, that must be so liberating.
It's incredible. That's why we never would do cans until...
And that's your version of never serve any wine before it's time.
Well, but it's right, exactly. Though. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
okay, so what's up for the... So you can still... There's a couple cans left of Lost Weekend at the bottle shop. And obviously, you can go and drink Lost Weekend at Blue Jacket. But what's up? So what can we get on Friday? What did you guys announce today?
So on Friday, we're doing another IPA. An IPA, you know, just big... hoppy beer that is called Turning Road, and it's probably our second most popular IPA. It's brewed with Mosaic hops. It's got a myriad of flavors in the nose, and all of our IPAs are really soft on the palate. They're not as bitter as they used to be. They're very kind of juicy and fruit forward. We're doing that, and then a double IPA that's called Full Fathom 5 that is stronger at 8% and equally
delicious.
Well,
for the uninitiated, and I do feel like, can you pop one so
David, sure.
We can all just taste it on air and discuss its fabulous flavors.
You are going to taste a beer.
I taste beer.
Question mark.
He knows that. He knows I taste beer. Thank you. Here, I'll let you do the inaugural sip. So, I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought. So what do you think?
Viva Lost Weekend.
Okay, very funny. No, seriously. Oh, I was going to ask about what's the difference between an IPA and a double IPA for the uninitiated.
Sure.
It's two IPAs.
Double it up.
Right. It's, no, seriously.
All it is really nowadays is an IPA with more hops, more alcohol, more everything. Standard IPAs come in around 6 to 7.5. Double IPAs typically come in like 7.5 up to 9%. For our IPAs, we use about... for our double IPAs, we use about 50% more hops than we do in our standard IPA. So you're going to get even more aroma, more flavor on the palate, and a little bit more intensity.
So what would you like people to get when they're trying Lost Weekend? I immediately smell, like, it's very citrus.
Totally.
A little bit of pineapple, believe it or not. But when you taste it, it's very full hop. But not bitter.
Not bitter.
At all.
Right. So we've added...
Goes down smooth.
We brew to kind of temper the things that people tend not to like about hops. When people dislike IPAs, they dislike the bitterness. So
I feel like beer geeks love that shit.
I jump in? Because I think there's a difference between drinking a beer on its own and wrapping a beer around food.
Like
when it is a little bit more bitter and it's really hoppy.
More food oriented.
If you're eating a pastrami sandwich with coleslaw and, you know, Swiss cheese and all that stuff, it's perfect.
It's perfect. And that's what we call like a West Coast IPA. It tends to be dry, bitter, kind of dank. These are more of like the juicy, hazy IPAs that are more less bitter, juicier, more fruit forward. Lots of tangerine and citrus fruit in the nose. And you're right, David. Like this, I wouldn't pair with a big, huge cheeseburger.
Right.
You know, but I would do this with light seafood preparation.
I'd have this with fish.
Yeah,
exactly.
Totally.
Yeah.
Like, actually, I mean, shout out to Sushi Capital. I don't know if you guys ever go there on Pennsylvania.
Okay.
So I live over on Capitol Hill.
For the moment.
Chef Ogawa used to work with a Mandarin Oriental for years. He retired here. He's got this little hole-in-the-wall sushi place on Pennsylvania Avenue right near the Tune-In that is incredible. Nobody really knows about it as much.
Until now.
The best omakase in the city for the price. It's cheap, delicious. And it's the kind.
You just said the magic word, and it wasn't delicious.
I know. Yeah.
But it's seriously, and you can do takeout from it. So I get raw fish takeout to my house and eat it with these like juicy, less bitter IPAs. It's awesome.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Excellent. All right. What can we look forward to next from you, Greg? Anything else on the horizon that we need to know about it?
You're hosting the Academy Awards.
Right.
Anything?
So he's looking at Molly. She's like, no, tell them.
We have a lot of really cool new projects on the that we're working on right now that I think are going to be departures for us and in some ways, but also just we're figuring out new ways to kind of showcase beer, and you know, there's a lot of new things coming up.
Well, did you want to ask a question about distribution? Because we talked about that off air.
No, I think we talked. I mean, because
We're not distributing cans. You got to come to the brewery to get them.
Right. But it's just not an avenue you want to go down.
No, not as much. We think the further away something gets from you, the more it can be treated poorly.
Well,
or
not only that, then you're arguing about shelving fees and all that other bullshit.
And then you lose margin, you know. But we are looking at a second Blue Jacket brewery to open.
In Kensington, Maryland.
Not Maryland, unfortunately. But in Virginia, with the idea, again, not to make like a giant amount of beer, but to make a little tiny small brewery where people can come and enjoy it on site. And we have some other projects we're looking at further afield.
And I do want to let people know, because we were talking about this off air, that you guys actually offer beer tours of the brewery. You can go in at, just like you would go to a winery and do a wine tasting. You can go in, get a whole tour, do a tasting, do a food and beer pairing.
Yep.
I mean, I think that's
it's pretty unparalleled tour, I have to say. It's really cool.
I would say it was a tour de force.
Okay. On that note, tell everybody where they can find you, Greg.
You can find me at Blue Jacket Brewery down in Navy Yard, Church Key and Birch and Barley on 14th Street, and about 24 other places.
And go pick up the cans.
Oh, wait a minute. For those of you who are not here, that's Washington, D.C.
Oh, yes.
The new food capital of the world.
And you can pick up the new canned beers at the Bottle Shop, which is right next door to the brewery, down in Navy Yards. And if you haven't been down to Navy Yards, there's so much going on down there. You can spend an entire day down there. There's so much to do. Well, we want to thank you so much for joining us today. We want to thank Todd Thrasher for making up some pretty fabulous cocktails that you can get here at the Line Hotel. Next week, we'll be talking to Kathy Hollinger from the Restaurant Association in Metropolitan Washington. The Rammies are coming.
She is a tour de force.
But the nominations will be announced for the Rammies this year, and we are going to get the whole lowdown. Thanks for joining us today. This is David and Nikki Nellis at Industry Night. We'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to this program on Full Service Radio, broadcasting and recording from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Full Service Radio programming can be accessed live and archived on fullserviceradio.org. Our talk programming is available on most podcast apps like iTunes and Stitcher, and our DJ sets are available on mixcloud.com/fullserviceradio. Full Service Radio features over 30 weekly shows and over 50 local hosts covering every topic imaginable. If you want to be a guest or get involved, email us at info@fullserviceradio.org. Follow us on Twitter @FullServiceRDO, on Instagram and Facebook @FullServiceRadio. Thanks for listening.